Watching fireflies as they light up a soft, warm night is one of the pure joys of summer. As fireflies dwindle and send their last signals of the season, we'll find out what all that flashing is about. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here to demystify these bioluminescent insects. And horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here to answer your questions. And one of the things that the fireflies are probably excited about this summer is the 30th anniversary of Horticulture Day. 30 years of questions answered, lessons learned, and a whole lot of fun. We'll take a few minutes to reminisce. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you've probably heard this on Iowa Public Radio recently. Horticulture Day is turning 30 this summer. We are celebrating tomorrow with a field day at the Horticulture Research Farm outside of Ames, and of course, you're invited to that. It's from 1 to 4:30, open to the public, a free event. We would love to see you there, and we will be celebrating with some of the people who have been a part of the show from the very start, and a couple of those people are here with me today. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And also Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be here.
And as I've mentioned on the program before, it's thanks to your obsessive keeping of all of your day planners that we even know that Horticulture Day is turning 30 this year, because when Hort Day started, nobody thought this was a historic, momentous occasion. It turned out, of course, to be huge.
Well, and now you're making me feel old, that if
no,
I've been around here
too.
That is not my intention.
Okay, thank
at
you.
At all. No.
But yes, those old records, the paper calendars that we all used to keep, I still have them, and you have to go back through the paper records. There's nothing digital of those beginnings, and Richard and I have talked. We really don't remember that it started with a flourish, if it started with some sort of big announcement. I think it just came in with a whimper, and it has stayed ever since.
It was very sporadic initially, maybe once a month or so. And that was the case for maybe 2 or 3 years. And then it became more regular, I think.
Well, and I'm sure that it became more regular because people got excited about it. And, you know, back in the days when the show started, it was a big challenge. The Talk of Iowa was new and its future was pretty iffy. And of course, it was on WOI radio in Ames. And now I wasn't involved at the very start, although I came along about 10 years later, and I was producing Talk of Iowa as a student producer. And even then, it was just really a lot of pressure to fill all of the days of the week. So I'm sure that's probably how Horticulture Day started, was, oh, we have this tremendous resource with Iowa State University Extension, and these are people who can answer questions, and we can get the phones to light up, and that's an hour of radio. And then you guys came on, and you were so great that it turned into something that has lasted this long and will continue to last. And I think about, you know, my early involvement with Horticulture Day, because it's always been so much fun. And I know I've said this, I'm not a great gardener. I've never been much of a gardener, but I've always been fascinated by learning about all of the things that are talked about on Horticulture Day. So even back when I was a college student, I would listen and learn. And you guys, I don't know, I always tell people horticulturists are the best people on earth, because the Hort Gang has always been so much fun to spend time with, either in the studio or on the air. And I know a lot of other people feel the same way.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to know. And it's interesting, of all the things we do in Extension and all the things I do with meetings around the state, still about once a year, maybe every other year, someone turns around and looks at me and said, I recognized your voice.
Yes.
From hearing you on the radio. They have no idea what we look like, which is probably just as well.
Yes.
We're going to lose that anonymity tomorrow, by the way, when people actually see what we look like. And Richard and I have faces made for radio, so don't be too surprised and shocked by what we do look like. But the other thing that has helped, over the years, the audience has grown, the popularity has grown. But I recall in the early days, the time slot bounced around.
It did, quite a bit.
And sometimes it was Friday, and sometimes it was middle of the week, and sometimes it was part of the noon agriculture show. And it sort of bounced around time-wise and day-wise.
Right. 9 o'clock, I think 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock, yeah.
And having it settled into this talk of Iowa time has helped it. And that's because of the popularity of Talk of Iowa and how many and varied topics come up, and they're all enjoyable.
Well, thank you for that. But it also, I have to take a moment just to thank you, Richard, for all of the work that you've done over the years. Because, of course, on a talk show, we have a team of producers, mm-hmm. and they pick the topics or help to pick the topics and book the guests and all of that, except on Fridays, which, Richard, you take on producer credit as well on Fridays. And we really appreciate all the time, not just coming over every Friday for 30 years.
But, well, I try to schedule people about a month ahead. And for the most part, I don't have to twist too many arms. Mm-hmm. They volunteer readily, so it's not a problem, actually.
Well, that's great. But thank you so much for all that you've done. And I'm glad that you enjoy it, because we enjoy it. And we hope that Hort Day will be a part of Talk of Iowa for a long time in the future. And of course, Richard and Donald are both going to be there tomorrow. I'm going to be there tomorrow. Many other members of the horticulture gang will also be there tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of fun events. You get to tour the farm. We're going to have a live program. And we're even selling TGI Hort Day t-shirts at the event, which will become my new favorite t-shirt as of tomorrow. I can't wait to get my hands on one. But let's stop reminiscing for a little while, and let's talk about fireflies. And one of the reasons I want to talk about fireflies right now, I know it's the end of the season for fireflies, but it seems like in my corner of southeastern Iowa, it has been a remarkably good year for fireflies. This has been so much fun this year. And why are some years so good and other years we just don't see many of them?
Not only is it variable from year to year, it varies from place to place. I would have said it was an average or below average year for fireflies in my little corner at the northern edge of Ames, but out in the country, we've heard this from several people that this was a very good year. Let's back up and talk about how fireflies develop and where they come from. Even though we call them fireflies or we call them lightning bugs, they are beetles. And all beetles have a complete life cycle of four stages: egg, larva, pupa, and adult. Firefly larvae live in damp locations where they are predators feeding on other small critters. That sums up, I think, a whole lot of why they vary from year to year and from place to place. The larvae require a damp location. So if we go back to dry years, like 2012, there were fewer damp locations, or the locations weren't quite as damp, and the firefly population suffered as a result of that. But then when we get good spring rains in 2013, 2014, 2015, and the year stays damp, those damp locations stay very good for the firefly larvae, and the populations increase. So I hate to make it sound like there's just one factor, because there's probably a whole lot of things that I haven't thought of, but I think the weather has a big deal to do, and it has to do with the development of the larvae, not the development of the adult. One more thing, the adults you're seeing this year were born last year. So we're talking about not the weather right now, but the weather, what it was a year ago or 2 years ago when these populations were developing.
So if they were born last year, then they spend the winter in that larvae stage?
Yes. They're down in those damp locations under leaf litter, under the mulch, under tall clumps of grass, places where they can be down and sheltered and where they'll find the little critters to feed on. And that's where they stay through the winter and finish their development the following year and emerge as adults. We think of kind of at the 4th of July, for most of central Iowa at least, if you start thinking, when are you going to see fireflies? You may see a few of them in May, you'll see a few more of them in June, but they sort of hit their stride at the 4th of July.
Well, and you mentioned finding all those critters to eat. We think about a lot of insects as maybe eating leaves or pollen or nectar, that kind of thing. What do fireflies eat?
Well, they are predators. They are cold-blooded killers. In spite of their notion as idyllic and pleasant, in that larval stage, they are feeding on small critters. And largely what they're feeding on are snails and slugs and mites and the eggs of insects, the small things that they can pick up and take care of. So, yes, they may feed on small insect larvae, but slugs and snails are one of their main food supply. And anybody who grows hostas know that the slugs and the snails are in the damp locations, deep under the leaves, on top of the ground, under the mulch. So they're feeding on the other things that are hiding in damp locations.
So how big are the larvae?
They start out very small. They may be a quarter of an inch when they start, but by the end of their growth and development, they'll be anywhere from 3/4, maybe almost an inch, but probably closer to 3/4 of an inch in length.
That seems big to me.
Well, you know, the amount of matter that is in the adult firefly had to be in the larva, just like the amount of matter that's in a butterfly or moth had to be in the caterpillar. So in general, the larval stage is a little larger than the moth or the butterfly or the beetle is going to be. And so to get a good-sized firefly, and most of our fireflies are in that range of about 5/8 of an inch, 1/2 inch to 5/8 of an inch, to get a beetle that big, you had to have a good-sized larva as well.
So when do they go through this metamorphosis process to come out around the 4th of July or a little bit earlier? What is that process like?
Well, it's the same process that every fly goes through. It's the same process every caterpillar goes through in the cocoon or chrysalis stage on its way to becoming a moth or a butterfly. Every beetle goes through this. Every ant, wasp, and bee goes through this metamorphosis of a larva eats, grows, develops, becomes fully grown, and then hunkers down into some sort of a shell called a pupa. Sometimes it's a cocoon. In case of butterflies, it's called a chrysalis. And inside the pupa, the insect essentially digests itself, that the tissues that were larva are now digested and reassembled to make the adult. So the muscles are digested and the proteins then are remanufactured to make the adult insect. The fatty acids are remanufactured. The carbohydrates are reassembled. So what was an immature, a larva, is broken down, reassembled, and remanufactured into the adult stage in what truly has to be one of the miracles of metamorphosis.
And they come out and they start all this flashing, and we'll find out what the flashing is all about after our break. We're going to take just a moment, and we will be back with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Donald Lewis is here, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist. And remember, we are celebrating our 30th anniversary of Hort Day with a field day tomorrow at the Horticulture Research Farm outside of Ames. You can find information on our Facebook page and at iowapublicradio.org, also on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa. Open air and leave teardrops everywhere. You'd think me rude, but I would just stand and stare. I'd like to make myself believe that planet Earth turns slowly. It's hard to say that I'd rather stay awake when I'm asleep, 'cause everything is never as it seems. 'Cause I get 1,000 hugs from 10,000 lightning bugs as they tried to teach me how to dance. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. They'll be answering your questions in just a few minutes, so give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we've been talking about lightning bugs so far this hour, and Donald, we'd gotten up to the point where they become the lightning bugs we know and love. They go out about in the evenings and they flash their lights. What are they doing?
Well, they're communicating with other members of the same species. It's not for our benefit, it's for their benefit. And flashing by the different species of fireflies is unique. They may flash at different heights. They may flash with a slightly different color. They may flash at a slightly different time. They flash in a slightly different pattern. And all of that is unique to the species of firefly for the purpose of finding a mate. So what we see on a warm evening in Iowa, especially right at dusk, and this is why the firefly we have, the eastern firefly, is so enjoyable to watch, is you don't have to stay up late at night to see it. Right at sundown, right at dusk, the fireflies will start flashing, and what we see about 2 to 3 feet above the soybean canopy across the field are mostly males. And what they're doing is flashing a distinctive pattern for the purposes of attracting the attention of a female who will, if receptive and of the same species, will flash back. And that's how they find each other. That's how they get together. Mating occurs, otherwise known as sex. Sex occurs, and another generation is the result.
So we get to watch their courtship dance and enjoy that.
Yes, that's a nice way to put it, that it's courtship. That's what they're doing, you know? It's like people circling at a dance floor, trying to attract the attention of someone of the same species for that. So, yes, it's all about courtship, and it's all about sex and the life of the insects. It's exciting to see, and it has all this other significance laid into it as well, and especially the part that each flash is separate. We have a large number of firefly species here in the United States, and a good number in Iowa, but the major firefly we have is the one that flashes at dusk and just a couple of feet off the ground, and that's very specific to that species.
How long do the adults live?
Not long, maybe a couple of weeks, maybe 2 to 3 weeks, but they will be here for a longer period of time. We can see some in April, or we can see some in May, we see some in June and July. We'll see a few left in August. So it looks like they've been here for three months, but each firefly only lived for a couple of weeks. And that peak that we hit in the middle of the summer, about the 4th of July, is when they are most abundant, and that's when most of the mating is taking place and occurring, and most of the eggs are being laid for the next generation. But the lifespan of the firefly adult is pretty short, especially when you consider the fact that the larva got to live for almost an entire year.
That is fascinating. And it's kind of mind-boggling to think about the evolutionary process that would lead to this beetle having this bioluminescence and this amazing communication system. I mean, this is pretty unusual in the in the natural world.
There are other bioluminescent species. I've watched a click beetle in Costa Rica with two bright dots on its back fly around. So it's not only fireflies that have bioluminescence. And, of course, there are some algae and some other organisms that have this ability to produce light. And the good thing about this light of fireflies is there's no heat. It's a cool light. They're not burning off a filament in their tail end, the underside of the abdomen where the light-producing organ is contained. It's a cool light. It's not hot to the touch, which is good for them, but it's an interesting process that several organisms over the evolutionary history have been able to come up with this deal of mixing two chemicals together in the presence of oxygen, and voila, light occurs.
It is a bright and beautiful brief lifespan for the lightning bugs. And thank you so much for telling us about them, Donald. I think it's time to turn to questions about insects, but also about the plants in your life. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to start off today with some email questions. And let's go with Chris's first. I keep losing my rosemary, etc. during the winter. What can I do to keep them alive until spring? Mm. We're thinking way ahead now.
Yeah, they're hard. Typically, you bring them inside and you hope they survive. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. The main thing is not to overwater. If you keep them too wet, that's kind of a death sentence. So water them well when you do so, but then let them dry out before you water again. Put them in a sunny window. And cross your fingers.
And check frequently for spider mites.
That could be a problem, yes.
They're really a problem on rosemary when you get them into the dry environment inside. So it's a challenge.
All right, here's a question from Joanne in Fairfax. How do we get rid of the millions of millipedes outside our house that make their way into the house? Nothing seems to be working on them. We've used some spray on the outside of the house, but it doesn't seem to help.
This is really one of the tough ones, and millipedes originate in damp locations. So those locations that are developing firefly larvae are also developing sow bugs, millipedes, and a few other things that live under the leaf litter, under the mulch, under the grass clippings, where there's constant dampness for these kinds of critters. Millipedes then get a wanderlust, and they start migrating long distances. And when that happens, and when your house is in the way of their migration, they're going to come inside if they can find a gap or a crack or someplace to get in under a door, the crack between the foundation and the siding. Our first defense would be to seal up the cracks and gaps where they get in, but we know they've got all night to go somewhere, they have nowhere to go and all night to get there, and they're just going to keep looking until they find these cracks and
really
gaps.
And they're really tiny.
That's right. They're very small. So they can come in through those cracks and gaps. That would be the first defense. Insecticides around the outside are not very effective because we don't have anything that will kill millipedes quickly. And you put out a little barrier of spray, even if you sprayed a couple feet of insecticide, it's not going to kill them in the time it takes them to walk 2 feet across the spray you've put down. Sometimes it gets so bad that people spray their entire yard to try to create not a barrier against your house, but a barrier that surrounds your house, this huge area. But these migrations are temporary. It's annoying. The good news is they're harmless. They can't bite. They can't sting. They don't carry diseases. And they're beneficial because they're nature's recyclers.
All right. Yeah. So not no easy answer to that one.
Was that a long way of saying live with them?
Right. I think so. Okay. I think so. And yeah. All right. We'll probably say that again a few times in the next coming weeks as the fall migration into your home continues. Here's an email from Shadley. My tomato plants took off this year and outgrew the little space I have them in. They're producing fruit, but about half of them have black spots on them. Is this because there's not enough circulation between these crowded plants or something else? Can I prune tomato plant branches without killing the plant to give them more room? This is my husband's idea, she says.
Okay. The black spots, if they're on the fruit, might be bacterial spot or speck. And it's a bacterium. It's hard to control. If you have a very crowded environment, and so when it rains, the foliage stays wet for quite some time, then you create conditions that are favorable for bacterial spot and speck. Fungicides aren't very effective. You typically want to destroy the plants in the fall. Remove them from the area and destroy them. And then next spring, plant your tomatoes in a different location. As far as pruning the plants, try to keep that to a minimum. And maybe next year, plant them farther apart when you plant those in the spring. And maybe grow them in a cage or some other support system.
All right, let's get to the phones. First up, Paul is on the line in Ankeny. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about carrots. Carrots that I plant in July and then harvest in late October, early November, are just sweet right at harvest. But the carrots that I plant in the spring and then harvest about now don't seem to be so sweet. And I wonder... Do they need to be harvested and then put in the refrigerator for a while to sweeten them up, or is that just the way things are?
It's basically the environment and the genetics of the actual variety. So storing them is not going to change their taste. No, it's not. So
okay.
You might want to look next spring in the catalog and try to find a variety noted for its sweetness, and maybe try that next spring.
Okay, I'll do that.
Yep, thanks a lot for your call, Paul. 866-780-9100. Next up, Trish in Dows. Hello, Trish.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, we've got a question about an insect that we're trying to identify. We're not sure if it came in some mulch or some plants that we purchased. And the insect is about, I would say about a half inch long from the tail to the head. And it looks like an ant, but it's not an ant. And it has some pinchers on the end of the tail.
There you go. That was the word we were looking for. We were looking for the word pincher, and it came out. So ding, 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 that's the right word. These are called earwigs. And earwigs are, like you say, half an inch long, kind of reddish brown in color. They have about a fourth of their body length are the pinchers on the tail end, and both the males and the females have pinchers. And when they run, they tend to hold those pinchers up in the air and kind of wiggle their body a little bit as they're running. They live in damp locations. It's the day of damp location critters. So down where the millipedes and the sow bugs and the lightning bug larvae are living are the earwigs, and that can be under the saucers of your pots, that can be in the deep foliage of your petunias, it can be under the mulch around the outside of your house. But you're not responsible for this. You didn't bring them in. They came on their own, and they're pretty widespread. They're throughout the United States, and they vary from year to year, and this year just happens to be a bumper crop, and more people are seeing them than ever. They're scavengers. We could live with them if they didn't get into the house. And if they do get into the house, it's best to vacuum or sweep them up and throw them back outside.
They look a little scary. I think people get wigged out by them. But that's for you, Donald.
Thank you. They get wigged out.
But they don't actually hurt people.
No, they don't hurt people a bit. The superstition out of Europe was that the earwig would burrow into your ears and lay its eggs. And that's a myth. They could crawl into your ears, but then flies and beetles and ants and other insects crawl into your ears as well. So the
you're making people feel a lot better.
Yeah, okay. That's right. You know, ear canals are, quote, a damp location. And so anything that wants to hide in a damp location could crawl into your ear. But earwigs are the ones that get that reputation that, you know, they're looking for your ear. In fact, they have the name ear in their name. But the part, the wig part comes from the fact that they wiggle when they run. They feed on plant foliage, but they're scavengers that feed on decaying organic matter. They're an accidental invader that gets into the house. They're a nuisance. They can't bite. They can't sting. They may cause a little plant damage. Damp locations are what we want in terms of growing lots of our plants, and our container gardens have to stay damp all the time. So we're creating the habitat where they live, but we're also creating a habitat where insecticides will not work very well. So tolerate as much as you can. If you have to use insecticides, try to spray the ground around the plants that are infested. Try to spray a threshold, a spray barrier across the threshold. But this is one that's as tough to control as millipedes.
All right. And those pinchers look scary, but that's not going to cause you much trouble.
They don't hurt us with them. They combat each other with them, and the males and females seem to use them in their mating ritual some way, but it's not a problem for us.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Trish. Next up, we've got Mary in Iowa City. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering, well, maybe it's just me, but I've noticed that it seems like crabgrass is hugely abundant this year, more so than regular. And I'm just wondering if that's just me or if there's some reason for that.
I think it's because of all the rain we had this spring. And the weather the last two or three weeks has been ideal. Crabgrass is a warm season grass. It loves warm weather, humid weather, moisture. It loves that. So it's an annual grass. It dies in the fall. But before it does, it produces a lot of seed. And those seeds typically germinate in May, and we typically start to see the crabgrass maybe mid to late June. And then it really grows well in July and August. So it's very, very common right now. It's easy to spot. It's a broadleaf grass, a light green color, easy to spot. But it will die this fall with the first hard frost to freeze.
Short of using chemicals, does it help to pull it up?
Well, you can do that, but if it's that common in your lawn, it's going to be hard to do. The easiest way to control it is to apply a pre-emergent herbicide in the spring. Typically, that is a chemical, but you can also use corn gluten meal, which is a natural product. But you need to apply that in the spring, and that will prevent the actual germination of the crabgrass seeds.
All right, and corn gluten meal, we've talked about on the program before, so you could go back in our archives and find out more about that. But they've found it to be extremely effective as long as you apply it every year, right?
Right, right.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Mary. Thanks a lot for your call. And let's try to squeeze in one more question here. Francis in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Francis.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I hope I'm not too far out of line, but can you give me any ideas on how to keep a squirrel out of a pear tree?
Oh, well, actually, we maybe can't.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult because they can jump. They can jump from the ground into the tree or from another tree into the tree. And so they're hard to keep out of a tree. Difficult.
Are they problems in pear trees?
I could see where they might feed on the fruit when it approaches maturity, possibly. Other than that, probably not, no.
All right, so maybe not a big problem. This one's an email from Jenny. I'm letting the milkweed grow in my yard. What are the large cone-shaped growths near the top?
Those are the seed pods, and they contain many, many seeds. And eventually they'll split open, and you have these seeds. They're brown seeds with kind of a fluffy appendage, and they just float away in the wind.
We are taking your questions today on Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We're also celebrating our 30th anniversary of Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa and Iowa Public Radio. We'll be celebrating in person tomorrow with a field day at the Iowa State University Horticulture Research Farm outside of Ames. You can find details on our webpage, iowapublicradio.org, on our Facebook page, and also on our Twitter feed as well. We would love to see you there. It's from 1 to 4:30 tomorrow. With me this hour, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist, and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. They will both be at the event tomorrow, along with many other members of the Hort Gang. You'll get a chance to tour the farm, and also we'll do a little program, and you can even buy a TGI Hort Day t-shirt at the event as well. We hope to see you there, and we'll get to more questions in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist, and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. And this isn't a question. It's just a lovely note from Chris in Coralville. She says, I love Hort Day and look forward to it every Friday. The Hort Gang has been very inspirational to me. Their knowledge has inspired me to grow more in my own garden and become a master gardener. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and passion.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it's what we do. It's our job.
And you
it's do also
it.
Fun.
Right. And how many of us get to say that about our jobs? We're fortunate people. So, all right. Questions. 866-780-9100. Rihanna is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Rihanna.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I actually have two questions. One question is about ticks. Some people say that you put oil or petroleum jelly on the ticks, you let them die, and then you let them fall off. And others say, no, that's not a good idea because the head emits stuff and you want to take it off life. And what is the best way of taking ticks off? And if it's taking it off when it's alive, what's the best way of doing that? And then I have the second question is, what is the best way of neutralizing wasp, bee, hornet stings on the body?
All right, Rihanna, we'll start with ticks.
Ticks
Donald.
Removal.
Yep.
There are lots of frauds and fakes and myths about tick removal, everything from nail polish to a cotton ball with lemon-scented detergent that you hold against the tick. All of those are fake and fraud. And as a reliable a resource as the Center for Disease Control says, there's one way to remove an attached tick, and that is to use your sharp-pointed tweezers, grab as close to your skin as possible, and pull straight upward. Ticks cannot let go quickly after they're established. Now, if a tick has just gotten on you and has not embedded its little barbed mouth parts into your skin, it can be brushed off, it can be pulled off with no trouble. But if the tick has been on for any length of time, and for an hour or more, it has barbed mouth parts embedded into your skin, and it cannot just let go. it has to work those barbs out slowly in order to fall off on its own. And that's not going to happen with any of the irritants we put on it. In fact, irritating a tick increases the production of saliva, and it increases the regurgitative feeding that they do. You increase the problems of a tick introducing foreign matter into your body by irritating it. The best thing is sharp-pointed tweezers, grab close to the skin, pull it out, dress the wound, because it will rip a little bit of skin loose. What neutralizes wasp and bee stings? Everything from meat tenderizer to ammonia to Sting Away. I think you just have to do your own experimentation on that one. I'm fortunate that I don't have to. Stings and mosquito bites, they don't bother me for too very long. I'm able to tolerate it until it subsides. But there are products in the store that you can try, and I don't know of anybody that's researched which one is the best. But now you've asked a question that I have to go think about, if anybody has researched which one is the best. But there are several things to try and find out which one works best for you.
All right. Hot shower sometimes. helps out as well.
Or a cold shower. Different things for different people.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Barbara's on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I recently had my soil tested at the ISU lab. I've got a flower garden in Des Moines, and I've got a couple of questions on the results. The only thing that's being recommended is nitrogen,
okay.
And I'll ask that question later. But my first question has to do with the phosphate and the potash. My numbers are way off the chart, high.
Right.
And I guess that's a good thing, but what we do every fall is we mulch the garden with shredded oak leaves. And I'm wondering if that's causing any harm at all.
Well, they would contain small amounts of phosphate and potash, but I don't think large amounts, so I don't think that's a major factor. It's not unusual when you test your lawn or garden, they have high levels of phosphate and potash. Those are very stable things. They don't leach out of the soil, so it's not uncommon to see those things. As far as nitrogen, you can apply just nitrogen-only products. Two of the most commonly available are blood meal, which is like 1200.
Okay.
And ammonium sulfate, which is 2100. So you can find those typically at most garden centers, either blood meal or ammonium sulfate. And I would apply maybe about a pound of that per 1,000 square feet in the spring. And if you're using something like 2100, that's about 5 pounds per 1,000 square feet.
Okay. I did look in the store, one store, and they had blood meal that was 600. Do you think that will work?
Should. Normally it's like 11 or 12%, but it should work, yes.
Okay, and it's one pound per 1,000 square feet.
1 pound of actual nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. So if you have something that's 21% nitrogen, 5 times 0.21 basically is one.
Okay. Okay, that answers my question.
All right, Barbara, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Ann is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering what happened to my green beans. I've seen this before, but this year it's particularly bad. The whole length of the pod is riddled with brown spots, and some of them look almost like they've been burrowed or blistered. Is that some bug that's chewing them up?
Do you have holes in the foliage too?
Yeah, some.
No.
Yeah, in fact, the bush beans are much worse. Like, the lower the bean is to the ground, the worse the spots. And my taller pole beans, a little less so, but it's getting worse.
Yeah. My guess is there's a combination of things going on, and the one insect that will feed on pods is called the bean leaf beetle. It also feeds on the leaves, so you get irregular round holes in the leaves, And when the bean leaf beetle feeds on the pod, it's very obvious that somebody chewed into it. It's not just a sunken little area. It's actually chewed away. Normally, we don't have enough bean leaf beetles in the home garden to justify an insecticide, but it could be done. I think it's not going to be warranted for most people, but if you're losing a lot of pods to the bean leaf beetle, and it's not parts that you can snap off and throw away, then a garden spray could be used. But when she mentions closer to the ground, are there any pod diseases, Richard?
It could be, but you would also probably see something on the foliage too, as far as some spots on the foliage. And if it was, a fungicide at this point would not be effective. It'd be too late for that.
And once again, it's the weather, the rainy period that we had early in the spring. Then we had all that rain at the beginning of July again. It has set us up for some of these problems.
And make sure you have adequate spacing between rows and plants. That may help a little bit.
Okay. What can I see those beetles? I have not seen any of them. Do they look like anything, or are they tiny?
They're visible to the naked eye. They're in that about 3/16 to a quarter of an inch. They are either red or yellow, and they have four square dots on their back. Now, it's hard to think of a dot being square, so it's kind of there are four square marks on their back. They're kind of secretive. Uh-huh. They tend to run to the underside. They tend to fall off when the plants are disturbed. But I think your experience is what most people have, and that is I find a little damage, but I never see the culprit, and that's because there just aren't very many culprits out there.
Yeah, well, I got a bumper crop this year. Thank you very much.
All right, Ann, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Glenn is up next in Ankeny. Hi, Glenn.
Yeah, hi. I was just starting to see some Japanese beetles this summer, and was wondering if your entomologist would have an update on what the status of Japanese beetles is this year.
Status can be summed up in two words: very spotty. Some people are seeing Japanese beetles for the first time, and they're thinking their world is coming to an end because of the defoliation of their roses or their grapes or their raspberries or their linden trees. Others of us are wondering, why aren't I seeing any this year? We had this wave of Japanese beetles back in the early 2000s that covered about two-thirds of the state of Iowa. There are still parts of the state where Japanese beetle has never been reported. But here, from central Iowa over to the eastern part, it's been at least found in every county, but that doesn't mean it's been found in every neighborhood. So there are neighborhoods, there are landscapes that are seeing Japanese beetle for the first time, even though others of us have had it since 2000. So very spotty is the status. Japanese beetle can usually be lived with at low levels, and if it's outrageous and you need to keep the plants green and you need to keep the foliage on the plants, not one spray, but several sprays will be required. So it's not an easy pest to fight. It's another one of our difficult ones to control because they're on so many things at so many different times.
Thanks very much.
All right, Glenn, thanks a lot for your call. And here's a question about ants. We're getting a lot of insect questions today. This one's from Wayne in Marshalltown. My next-door neighbor has been plagued with what appears to be anthills alongside his driveway. The dirt granules in the hills are much larger than normal, as are the piles of dirt. And then he says applying diazinon seems to only cause them to change locations. And then he added, oh, I just found out that diazinon has been banned by the EPA, just as chlordane was many years ago. Chlordane was very effective, but very hazardous. So his question is, what kind of insect are they, and how does one get rid of them? Not those chemicals.
That's right. Pavement ants are everywhere, and sometimes you have a lot of them, and sometimes you don't have very many. I think when we have good moisture in the soil, the ants do a little better. They love digging in that loose soil, the fill that was put under the concrete before it was poured. Some of that sand that's under there makes it for easy digging. They love those edges where they're going to dig. I think diazinon was okay, but we've never had anything that would knock them out completely. I think what happens when we use insecticides like 7 or bifenthrin or cyfluthrin, the new replacements for diazinon and Durzban, we suppress the population, but we don't eliminate the population. And I think for most of us, that's probably what we can tolerate. We spent some time a couple of shows back talking about the benefits of ants. Ants are aerating the soil. They're allowing oxygen and water to penetrate into the soil. Ants are predators that feed on other insects. At least these types of ants are. So maybe a little more tolerance for the anthills and control the ones that you really have to. I think a dry formulation, either a dust or a granule, is going to be better than a spray. So there, I've said everything I know about ants and more.
So that sounded like another maybe we can just live with them speech to me.
Oh, I've got a whole lot of those.
All right. Here's a question from Jody. We planted a red maple a few years ago on a sloping portion of lawn. We must not have done a good job planting because now the tree is leaning downhill. The trunk is about 2 inches in diameter and about 8 foot tall. Would staking it to become straight help? Will the tree learn to grow straight, or do we need to try to dig it up and replant?
Boy, I think I'd try staking, and I'd probably do that next spring when it doesn't have foliage. And when you do stake it, you want it to move some, so it shouldn't be held totally rigid. And you want to have something that goes around the trunk that is wide and will not cut into the actual trunk itself. So I'd probably do it next spring and very carefully bring it back, leave it there for a year, take it off next spring and see how it looks.
All right. Here's a question from Susan. I cut up a potato and planted the pieces this spring as a science project to see if I could grow potatoes. Right now, there is green growth above the dirt, but when will I know it's time to dig up potatoes?
You basically dig them up when the plants begin to die back. That's usually, if we plant them in the spring, usually sometime around late August or September. So when the plants basically have died back, then you dig them up.
All right. And this is a question from Ken in Cedar Falls. I have blossom end rot on my tomato. I read that this is due to calcium deficiency, apparently common in pot-grown tomatoes. I feed the plant monthly with Miracle-Gro. What can I add to alleviate the situation?
The best thing is try to maintain an even moisture supply. Don't keep it too wet, but don't let it get extremely dry also. Blossom end rot tends to be much more common on the first fruit that begin to ripen on the plants. Tends to be less common as we get into, let's say, August and early September. So try to maintain an even moisture supply. When you do water, water thoroughly. Let it dry out a little bit and then water again.
All right. And he has a second question. He says, also, I have a larger pot with pole beans that are being attacked by some brown flying beetles or something, leaving lacy leaves. Is there anything I can do about this? Not a fan of pesticides. Someone suggested a container of beer at the base, but the attack seems to be in the top foot of the plant.
My guess is he's talking about Japanese beetles.
Which we just talked about,
and that's particularly because of the word lacy. The Japanese beetles, when they feed on foliage, they eat the green material between the veins, but they leave the veins, so it looks like a piece of brown lace. What used to be a green leaf dehydrates and becomes brown. Yes, they love beans, and insecticides are going to be difficult to use, but a couple that would work in the garden, one is called Neem, N-E-E-M. It's a Japanese beetle repellent. It's a feeding deterrent. It's not going to kill the Japanese beetles, and it's also not going to be harmful to people and pets and wildlife and so forth. So that's one that works in that situation.
But they don't particularly like beer?
No. The pans of beer on the ground is for slugs, and slugs don't climb up and eat the leaves at the top of the plant. So I'm not sure where the beer recommendation comes from unless he was to sit at the base of the plant and drink the beer himself. Maybe that would help the interpretation of what's
the
going
outlook.
On. The outlook. That's right.
It's time to change your attitude. All right. Thank you both so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. And again, we are having a Hort Day 30th anniversary field day tomorrow. Donald Lewis and Richard Duran will be there. I'll be there. Many other members of the Hort Gang, the former host of this program, Catherine Perkins, will be there. And we'd love to see you, too. It is a fun event, free, and for the entire family from 1 to 4:30 tomorrow. You can find out more information on our webpage, iowapublicradio.org, on our Facebook page, or on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. Thank you so much. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. Have a great weekend.